How y'all doing? I'm an alcoholic. My name's Johnny Tatum. My sobriety date is February 14th, 2003. I got this flyer, one like it, in the mail, and I noticed, I looked, and the back of it was this lady, Tommy D, and first thing that caught my eye was her sobriety date was February 14th. And then I looked at the year, February 14th, 1961. What touched me about that is February 14th, 1961, my grandfather had his last drink also. 36 years old, he drank himself to death in West Palm Beach. Same day. It was kind of just two different roads, ain't it? Two different roads on the same day. Wow, kind of just gave me a little chill. I have a home group. It's the Lawley Primary Purpose Group in Lawley, Florida. Y'all know where that's at? Not many people do. We got one lady back there that does. Y'all have heard in the middle of nowhere? It's in the middle of it. We have a meeting there. It's the Lawley Primary Purpose Group. We meet every Monday night, 7:30. One meeting a week. Small town. There's about 15 or 20 of us in there, though. I have a sponsor. He has a sponsor. And my sponsor's sponsor has a sponsor. And we sponsor people out of the big book as originally intended. And for that, I'm gratefully, gratefully appreciative to him showing me this way of life. I'm a native Floridian. Matter of fact, my family, on my mother's side, came to Florida as French settlers way back before Florida was part of the United States. They landed in Mobile Bay and took a hard right turn and ended up in the Panhandle and have been there for all these years. My wife now, her family came to the state of Florida in the 1850s, so she's a relatively newcomer to the state. And my wife of 35 years, Chrissy, is with me tonight. And all I know, she was the prettiest girl who would talk to me at all. So I'm marrying her. That's all I need to know. I don't think she knew what she was getting in for. Just a little background real quick. I've lived in two houses my whole life, my mother and father's house and my house. I've had the same job my whole life, worked at a sawmill. I'm 56 years old, and I've got mail at the same spot all 56 years. I got my first bicycle I ever bought, a 26-inch Free Spirit Sears bicycle. Got my first new car I ever bought, 1980 Trans Am. Got the first Harley Davidson I ever bought, 1979 Harley Davidson Sportster. And I ain't telling y'all that to try and impress you. What I'm telling you is, to be a drunk, you don't have to wander off far from the house. You can stay right there and be a dadgum drunk. Now, where I grew up in Lawley is a real wonderful, wonderful neighborhood, wonderful place to grow up. It's a very rural, agricultural place. You either worked in the log woods or worked on the farm or ran cows. It's agricultural based and hard working people. My family's in the lumber business, run a sawmill. They have for many generations. My grandfather, I worked for him at a sawmill, and he worked for his grandfather at a sawmill, who told him stories about working for his grandfather at a sawmill. It's not that we're such wonderful sawmillers, y'all. It's just the opposite. We're really dumb. We figured this one thing out and we're sticking with it, okay? Daggone right. And growing up in that neighborhood, I was surrounded by my grandparents, aunts and uncles and cousins, and it was just a great place to live. Now, life centered around that sawmill. It centered around the mill. I grew up in a generation. I graduated from Bradford County High School in 1979. Reading and writing was not a requirement. You show up, they give you a diploma. Matter of fact, most of us back then, we graduated in what they called ag replacement. If you worked on the farm, or if you worked in the log woods, or if you worked in the cow pasture or whatever, it was the same thing as getting school credits, and they'd give you a diploma. And thank goodness for that, y'all. Thank goodness. But life centered around that sawmill. We were expected, when I came home from school, as early as elementary school, you throwed your books down and you got your butt to that sawmill. And work came first. Now, I'm not going to sit up here and tell y'all I was all that enthused about it. I was not. I came home, threw my books down, go to the mill. Education came second, work came first. I was not very happy about that growing up. But as I'm sitting up here tonight, I want to tell you, the greatest gift my father ever gave me was he taught me how to work. The single greatest gift that man ever showed me was he taught me how to work, how to bust my butt at a sawmill. And when I came in here, you daggum right, it paid off. Because this is work. Let's face it. This is a program of action. Well, I'd had some action all my life, and thank God for that man teaching me that. I was not very happy about it growing up. All the other kids were playing ball and after school and stuff like that. My butt was at the sawmill. During the summer, everybody else was looking forward to going to the lake. I was looking forward to going to the sawmill. But it was many years later that I was grateful for that. It was at that sawmill that I had my first, I don't know if it was my first drink. You know, they expect us to get up here and tell our stories. Hey, we can't hardly remember them. We throw rocks at it, y'all. And I was probably 10 years old, and I don't know if it was my first drink, but it was my first buzz. My cousin came over from Palatka with his father. His father is also in the sawmill business. And I was visiting my father. They were looking at parts, and he looked at me and my brother and said, "Johnny, you want to drink some beer?" And I said, "Sure, but we ain't got none." Well, he had a plan. And this was the plan. On the north side of the sawmill, there was two or three houses where some of the mill hands lived in it. The plan was this. Him and my brother were going to knock on the front door. I was instructed to look through the back door, and when the guy walked to the front door, go in and steal the beer. Well, folks, it went off like clockwork. I can remember this day, my brother and Jimmy knocking on the front door. Sam walked to the front. I slipped in the back to the refrigerator and stole a six-pack of Tallboy Budweiser. And behind the sawdust pile, we went. Now, my cousin looked at me and my brother and said, "Johnny, for this to work, we're going to have to down these two Budweisers really fast. We ain't got but two." So I remember popping that top, turning them two Budweisers down, boy, just hard as I can. Now, folks, I can't tell y'all why I drank that way the first time. Maybe it's curiosity. Maybe it was peer pressure. Maybe it's trying to fit in. I don't know why I did it that first time. But I can dadgum sure tell you why I did it the second time. I love the effect of the first one. And that is point blank. You know, I'm not putting down anybody. But I drank for the effect. All right? Anything to make me feel single or C-double, I'm doing it. All right? I just liked it. Anything to make my head spin, baby dog, give it to me. It's better not spinning. I thought it was the greatest thing. I thought it should be mandatory. Now, growing up in a rural area like that, it's hard to drink. But you got to have a plan. And I had a plan. The more boys that was older than me was always riding them old flatwoods roads, a lot of pine timber where I live. And they'd just ride those old woods roads for miles and miles and drink beer. And they'd let us younger boys ride with them. Well, if you aggravated them enough, they'd give you a beer to shut you up. Naturally, I was a very aggravative youngin'. And you know what? Those guys were not trying to hurt me. They were not. They were just, as I look back on my life, I was training people at an early age to accept the way I drank. By the time I was 12, 13, it was nothing for Johnny to go to the beer cooler and get all the beer he wanted. It was normal by then. It was normal. There was always somebody making some old homebrew around where I'm from. A lot of strawberry wine, a lot of muscadine wine, a lot of elderberry wine. Y'all drank elderberry wine? Well, it's kind of like MD 2020 on steroids. It's hard to tell your daddy you ain't been drinking elderberry wine when your lips is purple, your tongue's purple, your fingers is purple. Everything it touches, it turns purple, but it's terribly effective. They always making a lot of whiskey around where I was from, a lot of sugarcane whiskey. Y'all drink sugarcane whiskey? Oh, baby, dawg, it's good stuff, all right? Son, it tastes just like corn liquor until you pull that bottle away. Then you can taste the sugar cane. Terribly effective, terribly effective. I drank for the effect. I never remember opening a bottle, smelling the bouquet, tasting it. I taste a hint of charcoal and oak. No, baby doll, I did not drink that way. I was not taught to drink that way. I did not want to drink that way. I wanted a buzz, and that's why I drank, okay? Besides happy occasions, sad occasions, mad as hell occasions, what the Gators won, the Gators lost, I just like to drink, okay? Now, drinking didn't cause me a lot of trouble growing up. Although when I was 18 or 19, I'd bought that Trans Am, thought I was Burt Reynolds. I was drinking pretty heavy. I was driving pretty fast down the highway, passed the county cop. They called ahead. They were waiting for me down there, and they took me to jail. Now, I'm laying in the county jail that night, 18, 19-year-old boy, and I make a vow. I'll never drink and drive again. I'm done. A week later, I was drunk, run into a lady. So forever is a week for me. I don't know about y'all, but a week. Got married when I was 21. Married this girl from Keystone. She's from a neighboring town. I tricked her. She didn't know. All I know, she was beautiful, and she looked at me and smiled, and that was her worst mistake she ever could have made. And the only thing I can see wrong with her, she's Baptist. Other than that, everything's okay. I'd quit college and bought into family business, sawmill business. I always knew what I was going to do. There's me and my brother, my father and his brother. And when I was 26, I had my first child, a little girl, Chelsea. Oh, yeah, I love that little girl. I'm telling you right now. And I love being a dad. And I love being married. And that little girl, she just came out smiling. I mean, just, I don't know. Unless she's on me. She just owned me, okay? And when I was 28, my son Jack was born. And I love being Jack's dad, too. Now, there's a lie that goes around Bradford County. I'm going to straighten it out right here before y'all ever go up there. That I named my son Jack after a bottle of Jack Daniels. That ain't true. Jack means son of John. I just happened to drink a lot of Jack Daniels. Just coincidental, okay? Things were going pretty good. My drinking increases. When I got out of high school, I bought my first Harley Davidson. Still got it. And I start running with that little motorcycle crowd. And I'll tell you something about running a motorcycle crowd. They drank a heck of a lot like I did. And I enjoyed that. Now, I'll tell you something about them Harley Davidsons. I got to studying them. I'd study them. I'd look at bikes and look at magazines and look at this and watch movies and go to this place. And I would study everything about them so when I went to a swap meet or a motorcycle show, I could walk to the antique section of the motorcycles and I could look at those guys and I'd say, hey, that's not original. That didn't come on there. And I would build my self-esteem at those guys' expense, trying to make myself feel better by sharing this knowledge, everything I'd done. And you know what? It's kind of funny about us drunks. I kind of wore my welcome out with that much. You know, it's hard to wear your welcome out with a bunch of bikers who are drinking like you did, unless you're the troublemaker, unless you're the one that's always causing problems, unless you're one that's always getting the law called, unless you're the one that's always broke down drunk laying in the ditch, unless you're the one that, I'll tell you what happened, they'll go on runs and they won't call you. And your feelings will get hurt. And you'll find you another group to run around with. And they'll figure out who the heck you are, what kind of drunk you are, what kind of troublemaker you are. And then they'll go off and leave you. The heck with them. So I decided what I needed to do was get me a boat. Daggum right. Can't have just any boat. Bought me this Egg Harbor Sport Fisherman. I don't know if y'all know what that is. It's a beautiful classic boat. Parked it at the marina in St. Augustine over at the Conkhouse Marina. And son, it looked good. It's like having a 57 Chevy. And baby doll, I look good on it. Woo! Yeah, and you know, when you show up to a place like that with a beautiful boat and you have a nice wife and two kids following you down the marina, the people are happy to see you there. The people at the marina tie you up right up front. Oh, welcome to our marina, Mr. Tatum. Park here until they see the freak show following you down the dock. Bunch of old bikers, bunch of old people that they escaped from the mental institution. And all night party is going on in my boat, and it causes them resentment, and they get mad, and they'll move you here, and they'll move you here, then they'll move you out. And then I did the same thing with them daggum boats. I did them motorcycles. I'd study them. I'd just look at magazine after magazine and walk up and down the dock studying. So when I was standing on the dock, I could see a boat coming, and I could name the classics like the Ricky Scarboroughs and the Andy Morgans and the Rabovich's. Look at the boy beside me and say, what's wrong with you? Don't you know? You've been hanging around boats longer than I have. Once again, building my self-esteem at your expense. Not even knowing I'm doing it. Well, I got burnt out on boats or the people. You can only go to so many marinas in North Florida. Decided what I needed to do is get back to my roots. So I started showing cows. My family always run cows, but we can't just show any kind of cows, can we, darling? We had to send, get the best cattle there was, and we started showing on the American Brahma Association circuit. We're showing Brahma cattle. We show Tallahassee, Gainesville, Jacksonville, Tampa, Orlando, Kissimmee. There were several shows, and I'm telling you, son, I looked good when I pulled up. Brand new four-wheel drive, pretty wife, nice-looking cattle. And those people at those cow shows are glad to see you when you pull up that. Until they see the all-night party going on at your stalls back there, and it pisses them off. Because their families are there, too, and they're seeing my wife and my children exposed to this. And the next thing you know, resentment starts. The problems start again. And I did the same thing with those cows. I did those boats and those motorcycles. I studied those cows and studied them and studied them and studied them. Till when at the cow show, I could name the bloodline of the cow in the arena and the bloodline of the cowboy showing the cow, baby. I knew it. Once again, building my self-esteem at your experience. Well, my drinking got worse. My drinking got worse. And this is what a normal life became with me. Everyday drinking became a regular thing. Over-drinking became a regular thing. I was working, boys. I wouldn't miss work. I'd work every dadgum day. I was there and get drunk at night. In a small community like you live in, word gets around. We got one high school in the whole county, one red light in our little town. And everybody knows who's the drunk and everybody knows who isn't. You know, we have an obsession that talks about it on page 155 of the big book that nobody knows of our drinking. Well, son, let me tell you, they know. I remember my little girl came home, and our little school went from kindergarten to eighth grade. And she came home one day, and she says, "Daddy, all the kids at school say that you're drunk. If you ride by, she has to play by herself. The other mothers don't want their kids playing with my kids. This thing might be contagious. She has to suffer for my consequences." My little boy that I love so much, this little boy that I just adore, that I take a bullet for, he starts hiding in his room because he don't know what kind of dad it is. He don't know if I'm happy drunk dad, pissed off because I ain't drunk dad, mad as hell, determined not going to talk to you because I want to get drunk dad, arguing over what I'd got drunk the night before dad. He just starts developing nervous habits and just hides inside himself, crawls inside himself. My wife is trying to balance a checkbook by all means should be going up, but it's steadily going down. She don't know if the next phone call is where I'm drunk in jail, wrapped a motorcycle around a telephone pole, killed somebody or killed myself. And this becomes a normal way of life. My father at this time, you know, when I was probably 30 years old, some storms hit the state of Florida. And the sawmill business was good for us until that time. I was making a good living. But when those storms hit the state of Florida, the sawmill business went out of sight, y'all. I'm talking about lumber went out of sight. We went from 10 employees to 20 employees to 40 employees to 60 employees. We bought up several thousand acres of land around Bradford County. I was like Bill W. in the story. I had arrived. Now, where I'd arrived was at a sawmill. It was a little different than a golf course, but I had arrived. I was Mr. Tatum now. And my father, there's one little old restaurant in our town. He should be able to go down there and enjoy breakfast with them old men who meet down there every morning. But it gets where he can't even do that because the minute he walks in, what they'll say to him is, "Hey, Tom," that's his name. "You know where your boy was last night? Hey, Tom. You know who your son's running with? Hey, Tom, your son's going to hell. Hey, Tom, your son's going to jail." And this becomes a normal way of life for him. I mean, I go places and I hear people's story all the time, and I love them. But let me tell you something. I hear people talking about how bad they had it. Let me tell you who had it bad. Not the ones you loved, but the ones who loved you. That's who had it bad. See, I'd come in, I had a whiskey bottle to suck on that night. She didn't have anything. She didn't have anything. Before you get to thinking about how bad you had it as a drunk, get to thinking about your loved ones who had to watch you do this. Your parents, your children, your friends, your brothers, your sisters. You think you're powerless over alcohol? You don't understand powerlessness like the family member of the drunk does. I had some relief. I had a bottle of Jack Daniels to suck on. They didn't have anything but the pain I was giving. And it becomes a normal way of life. Well, let's cut to the chase, y'all. I drank myself till I was having visual and audible hallucinations. I was that type of drunk. So I started hearing things and seeing things, and they decided I needed a psychiatrist. They were right. So he took me to psychiatrist, and I'll tell you, that man liked me, and he tried to help me, but I was not honest with that guy. He gave me some antipsychotic drugs, and they would knock you out. And I guess my head was spinning like the Jackson 5, and I needed knocking out. Excuse me. And I hated the way they knocked me out. So I started mixing them with cocaine and Jack Daniels. And they didn't knock me out anymore. They did about kill me, though. February 14th, 2003. After this becoming a normal way of life, I lied at the mill and told them I was going to get some flowers for my wife. It was a lie. I was going to get some whiskey. Pulled in the end of my driveway, and my father was coming from the other end of my driveway. I got a long driveway. And we met about halfway, and I didn't want to see him because I'm already lit up. He gets out of his truck, and he's got a shotgun. I said, oh, my gosh, he's going to shoot me. He loads it and pokes it underneath his chin. And I looked at him. I said, what are you doing? What are you doing? He says, watching you kill yourself is killing me, and I can't take it anymore. And I want you to see what it's like to see somebody die. And I just fell on my knees and opened my arms, and I said, look, shoot me. I can't take this anymore either. And he turned the gun. See, I was ready. I was soul sick, y'all. I wasn't liking what I was doing. I was beyond physically sick. I was beyond mentally sick. I'd reached that point of soul sickness where I didn't care if I lived or died. And I had driven this man, this proud man. See, there's something y'all got to understand. He's the patriarch of the family. And they blamed him for my drinking. They would go to him and say, why are you letting him drink this way? Why are you putting up with this? He didn't have any more control over it than I did. And this is what I pushed him to, murder, suicide. Evidently, he had told my mother what he was going to do, and she told my sister. And I remember my sister coming down the road blowing the horn. And my wife had seen what was going on outside the door, and they intervened and diffused the situation. They called Gainesville. I live an hour north of Gainesville. They called Gainesville, and they took me to a treatment center over there. And it was a real high-dollar, nice treatment center. It's where they send all the doctors and the lawyers and the professionals over there. Real nice place, FRC. And I didn't want to go there. And I ain't going to stay there. And I got a plan. And this is the plan. Boys, I was raised with that old sawmill language. Y'all, I know that old sawmill language as good as anybody else. And I got in there and I talked to people like they were dogs, okay? I talked to every patient in there just as rough as I could. And I know how to bull up and talk to them. I was raised around a sawmill. I was taught by the best, okay? Well, it worked on all the patients. They were scared to death of me, and they hated me. It didn't work on the doctors and the nurses. I guess they was used to people like me. I was in there probably a week, maybe a week, and I'd walk the one side of the room. Everybody else walked the other side of the room, and I went to the detox part. I'd walk this side. They were scared to death of me, and I'd cuss them as we passed. I was in there about a week, and a black guy named Don came in there, and I seen him at the door, and I said, oh, show this joker, and I lit into him. Started cussing, throwing one of them sawmill fits. And that joker started cussing back at me. Come to find out, Don was a truck driver, and he knew the language better than I did. Don called me names I ain't never been called before. It kind of ended in a standoff, and I said, to heck with you, Don. He said, to heck with you, Johnny. We went our separate ways. And later on that night, Don came over to me. He says, Johnny, you're the most miserable SOB I've ever seen. I said, to heck with you, Don. He said, will you give me 5 minutes of your time? And, folks, I don't know why I did this. I still don't know. I went in his room, and he had a Bible laid out. He said, get down here on your knees. And I got on my knees, and he read something out of the Bible. Now, I can't remember what he read, but I remember it touched me like my grandma had read it. You know what I mean? It hit me in that soul part. You know what I mean? It's kind of got me. And he grabbed my hands, and he looked up and said, Johnny Tatum, for the first time in your life, you admit that you are drunk, and you're going to die a drunkard's death if God doesn't save you. So I'm in that treatment center for a week. And I look up to heaven and I say, God, I'm a drunk and I'm going to die a drunkard's death if you don't save me. And I don't know what happened. I know white lights or bells or whistles or nothing like that. But, y'all, I became willing to do what it takes. They took Don out of there the next day. He was in there for 2 days. And I've never seen him since. I tell the story because one day I hope he'll stand up and holler, "Johnny, it's me, baby," and I want to see him again. But I tell you the reason Don got to me. He talked to me in a language I understood. All them other people were saying, "We're going to love you back to health," and I knew they was lying. I said, "Get the heck away from me." Don cussed me like I needed. Now, I'm not telling y'all to go start cussing people. That is not what I'm saying. Please, Johnny Tatum told me to start cussing newcomers. That ain't what I said, all right? Please. But it's what got to me. He was the first honest drunk I ever met who told me about myself, who wasn't giving me some kind of bull crap, "We're going to love you back to health" stuff, which I knew was a dadgum lie. He told me I was a dadgum drunk and I was going to die a dadgum drunk's death. And I believed him, and he got my attention. I filled out a paper from Bridging the Gap, and thank God for those people who do that work. I'd never been to AA before. The only AA meeting I've been to was in that dadgum wind-up joint, that old nut house, and the people come here, and I filled it out. They sent it back to Bradford County, and two people showed up from a meeting there in Bradford County, and I knew one of them was a girl I used to drink with, and she was sober, and she told me where the meeting was. I did my time in that nut house. I spent 6 weeks there. And you know what? I kind of fell in love with them old boys and girls in that nut house. After I was overcome with that, it just took the hate out of me for some reason. And I got a sponsor, and I showed up at that first meeting, and there was three of us. And I was okay with that. I didn't care. And I started doing that step work. And within a few months, I had worked the first nine steps. I remember doing my fifth step at that old boy's farm who was sponsoring me that time. And when I was leaving that farm, I was overcome with a feeling I'd never drink again. I mean, I tried a lot of stuff not to drink, okay? I had self-help books, going to church, not going to church. I bought two Bowflexes because, I bought one Bowflex and it didn't have the press bar, so that's why I didn't stay sober. So I got, you know, it's just crazy stuff, but I never did a fifth step. I never did anything like this. Never had I did anything like this. And I remember driving down that dirt road leaving that farm. I said, "Man, this is different." And the eighth and the ninth step was for me, and especially my small community and my family being so close, it was pretty powerful. I sat my father, my brother, my uncle down in the office. That's who I'm in business with. And I did my worst amends first. I looked at him and said, "Look here, baby doll. I've been stealing from the company. I've been showing up drunk." They said, "We know." He said, "But hearing you say it does something for us." They come up with a sum of money they wanted, and I commenced to pay them back. And I stopped. That was as far as I made it, baby, step nine. No 10, 11, 12. I fell in with this group of guys that's kind of, I don't know what else to call them besides the meeting makers make it bunch. And they told me all I had to do to stay sober was make meetings. Matter of fact, they told me I got this through osmosis. Whoever got their ass to the Moses meetings got it. That's what they told me. So I'm. This is what I'm doing. I work all day at that sawmill. I come in, take a shower. I drive an hour to Jacksonville to a meeting because I live halfway in between. I come home that night, go to bed. Wake up next morning, go to work, take a shower, drive to Gainesville that night to a meeting, come home, go to bed. And then I fired her from every job she held. She'd held the family together. She'd held the finances together. She'd kept my children in church. She had run everything. "You're fired. I'm sober now. I'm taking over." And I tell you, the only my, you know, it's hard to enlarge a spiritual growth that you ain't got. Okay, you know, "I need to enlarge my spiritual life." Well, I didn't have one. I'm trying to enlarge something I ain't got, okay? I'd had an initial spiritual awakening, but I stopped, and it started fading. And I started getting miserable, but I'm afraid to tell anybody because I'm hearing the miracles of AA. And I get decided if I hear a miracle one more time, I'm going to cut their throat. And that's just the way I get more miserable, but I'm afraid to tell anybody because y'all are telling me how I'm supposed to be happy, joyous, and dadgum free, and I ain't happy, joyous, and dadgum sure ain't free. So at about 6 months sober, she moves me out of the house to the KOA campground. Now I'm living by myself, 6 months sober, 7 months sober, hating everybody in AA, and it has cost me what 20 years of drunkenness couldn't cost me, my family. And now I'm sitting in that dadgum KOA campground, and I hate everybody, but I won't tell you. And meeting makers make it. And so So I drive to Jacksonville. I tell you, it got so bad. I got to hating everybody, and I became such a fraud in Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I drive to Jacksonville, and I'd hear something really smooth, really clever, sounded really good. Then I would drive the next night to Gainesville, right? They're about 100 miles apart, good 100 miles apart. And I would position myself at the meeting, and I'd raise my hand. And I'd repeat what I'd heard in Jacksonville like I'd made it up. And they'd say, "Woo, Johnny, that's good. Yeah, 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 God's got me, God's got me." I'm a fraud. You know the only bad thing about being a fraud in Alcoholics Anonymous? Nobody else might not know you're a fraud, but you know you're one. And it eats at your soul. That same soul sickness that I had when I was drinking was coming back, baby. And I hated everybody, and I hated you, and I hated you, and I hated you. But after the meeting, I tell you how good you sounded, and I loved you. And we'd get a little group of haters over there together, you know what I mean? And we'd sit in back, and we'd hate on you. If we didn't like you, we'd cut your tires. Wait a minute. We didn't cut any tires. There's a better way to do that. What you do, you take the valve cap off. You take a little bitty pebble and you put in that valve cap. And you put that valve cap back on the tire. You do this three times. I learned this at Cal shows. That people hated at Cal shows too. And it lets the air out of the tire very slowly. And you let them leave first and you can pass them down the road and wave at them. Hey, baby! And the next day, the other tire goes flat. They don't know what the hell happened. That's the type of AA I'm involved with. And I think that's normal. Who I can hate, who we don't like, and who we're going to get on. Who we're going to bully and run out of the meeting. Who we're going to lie to. This becomes normal to the point that I can't hardly take it anymore. I remember I went to a gratitude meeting. I hated gratitude meetings. But I went to this one for some reason. I had nowhere else to go. And they were talking. I raised my hand. They said, "Yes, Johnny." I said, "I woke up this morning, and I looked across the pasture. There were two big old buck deer standing out there in the pasture. One was God, one was me. He's got me, boys." I said, "Ooh, that's good, Johnny." It was a lie. They weren't. I'm living in the KOA campground. There ain't no pasture. If they'd have been some deer out there, I'd shot them. I was more worried about impressing a bunch of dadgum drunks than I was impressing God. I was more worried about impressing a bunch of dadgum drunks than I was about impressing God. And that's the truth. Trying to build my self-esteem with everybody else. Well, I got things get worse. It gets crazier. All those guys I was running with, they're dropping like flies. I wouldn't go to any big book studies. The truth was I was scared of the big book. I was scared of it. But they would hang with me and they'd say, "Johnny, see those boys toting those big books?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "They're Nazis." Said, "They're going to die. They're miserable. They hate everything." And I'm thinking, I ain't hanging around that big. That gave me an excuse not to go to any big book meetings. It was a lie, but it was a good lie to me. Of course, the boys I'm hanging around with are dropping like flies. This one's gone. Now this one's gone. Now this one's gone. Now I'm all alone. My little group I'm running with has done got drunk and gone. And it was New Year's Eve. The only kind of meetings I went to were open, disgusted meetings. Open discussion meetings, and the only thing I heard that made sense during that whole crazy time that I was out there, I was in Gainesville at the Triangle Club, and I was whining woo-hoo-hoo about my situation, because I thought that's what you did at meetings. You carried your problems to the meeting and shared your problems with it. And some old guy walked up to me after the meeting. I didn't know him. He looked at me and says, "Johnny, if you'll learn to apply these steps to your life, apply them to your life. A year from now, you'll have your wife back or somebody else's." Never heard that before. New Year's Eve, I'm miserable. I'm at the Triangle Club in Gainesville, and I've had enough of Alcoholics Anonymous. I ain't planning on getting drunk. I just had enough of y'all. If this is all you got to offer me is pain and misery, I might as well do this crap by myself. And I decided to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why that was like on a Monday. I don't know why I showed up the next Tuesday to the little meeting I was going to in Stark. But I showed up and the GSR had gotten drunk. Our GSR had gotten drunk. And they went with six of us and they looked at me and they said, "Johnny, don't you got a car?" I said, "Yeah." They said, "Congratulations, you're GSR." Now here I am about 8 months sober, fixing to leave Alcoholics Anonymous, hating everybody, but I'm GSR. And all I can think, GSR, that sounds important. Dadgum right, GSR today, boys, president tomorrow. I didn't know there wasn't no president of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm seeing myself going up the political ladder already. Folks, let me tell you something. If you become the head person of Alcoholics Anonymous, guess what you are? The head drunk. What kind of dadgum title is that? You gonna put that on your resume? I'm the head drunk of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know nothing. I was ignorant to everything. Well, I show up at my first district meeting, and I run into a whole different side of Alcoholics Anonymous, y'all. I have never seen this. Those people were serious. They had their sponsees with them. They were worried about literature committees and archives committees and PPC committees and treatment committees and this and that. And there was something really different about them, too. They seemed very genuinely happy and contented. They seemed blessed. And I recognize it because I didn't have it. And the guy who was DCM was the guy who had brought the Bridging the Gap meeting to me. And I loved him because he's the one that showed up. And they invited me to go to this roundup in Georgia. Now, folks, I don't know why they called it a roundup. There weren't no cows there. So I go to this roundup, and I show up there. And the first night, there's this guy from Canada or something, and he's talking blasphemy. He says, meeting makers don't make it. It's not in the meetings you make, it's the steps you take. And I said, that's a dadgum lie. Everybody knows meeting makers make it. So you got to go to meetings. And then another guy the next night, and I can't remember word for word what he said, but this is what I've understood, he said. He said, in every group of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's two groups. He said, we have a group over here that are busting their butt. They're carrying the message to the treatment centers. They're doing the step. They're doing the district work. They're doing the sponsorship work. They're working these steps. They're trying to apply these principles to their life. He says, over here we got a group. He says, I'm not saying they're not alcoholic, but for some reason they don't have to do it. They're the softer, easier way people. They're the ones that tell you, find somebody you can relate to. Take your time. Don't rush into this. And they're both in competition for one person, the newcomer. And I'm sitting there listening to this man. I said, oh, my God. It's like somebody hit me in the head with a hammer. You knew which group I'd fallen in with. So I did something that was the hardest thing I did, and that was 10 months of sobriety. I walked up to the CD stand, these people back here who saved my life, and I asked that guy back there for some step study CDs. See, I had some CDs. They were like ha-ha speakers. They were cassettes back then. Comedy. And there's nothing wrong with comedy speakers of AA. There's nothing wrong with that, okay? And so he gave me a Joe and Charlie six-pack and a Bob Olson six-pack. And I went out to my car during all of this, and I started listening to that Joe and Charlie stuff. And you know what? That big book wasn't that difficult, y'all. I have a mechanical background growing up at a sawmill. It's not no philosophical novel. No, it's a how-to book, and it's dirt simple. Quit overreading it. And then I listened to Bob Olson, and he was the first man who talked about spirituality as a way of strength. Because all I was hearing was, you're going to be weak, you're going to be powerless over people, place, and things, rest of your life. And I ain't going for that. But Bob Olson talked about strength and power and sobriety and strength and power and spirituality. And baby, something happened to me. I called my wife. She was in Orange Park at Sofa World. I said, I got to talk to you. You can tell how worried she was about me at Sofa World. I showed up and I said, look, I've been a dadgum. I can't remember exact words. I've been a dadgum fool. Please let me come home. And she let me come home. You know, that old guy was right. When I started applying those steps to my life, my wife didn't let me come back. And that was at about a year sober. And I go crazy. I'm telling you, folks, I go big book crazy. I mean, radical. I became what those other guys were talking bad about, okay? I mean, I am, and I'm not doing it to build my self-esteem like the boats and the motorcycles and the cows. I'm not, because I really believe in this. For the first time in my life, I believe in something. And so I get my first sponsee, and where it says write something down, we write something down. Where it says pray, we pray. Where it says make a decision, make a decision. He's still sober. And I get the next guy, and I get the next guy, and I get the next guy. I come from a very prominent family in the county. Everybody knew I was hanging out at that Catholic church because I wasn't Catholic, all right? I think I'm Protestant. I know I wasn't Catholic. And they start sending people to me. And now I'm sponsoring two guys. Now I'm sponsoring five guys. Now I'm sponsoring 10 guys. And I am crazy, all right? That little group went from six people to 30 people, and I'm sponsoring 20 of them, all right? And everybody knows ye with the most sponsees controls the group conscience. Everybody knows that. Dadgum right. And we're changing all these open, disgusted meetings we're happening. It's going to be big book studies and step studies. And I ran into what you call bleeding deacons. And one of them was my sponsor. And he fired me. At 3 years sober, my sponsor fired me. Almost three. I have never been fired from nothing in my whole daggum life, y'all. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get fired. There was a guy I'd heard from Jacksonville, and he was an ex-area delegate that moved here from New England. And man, there's something that impressed me about him was his integrity. And so I asked him to sponsor. I did not ask him to sponsor me. I was sponsoring this boy named Rob. I said, Rob, you go ask that man to sponsor me. He wasn't going to turn me down. And Rob went to ask him. He agreed. And so I showed up, and Big Daddy Tom K, and he said, yeah, I'll sponsor you. So I show up with Big Daddy in Jacksonville, and I walk in, and you know, at first meeting, I'm expecting big book stuff and everything, because he's a big book man. And the first thing he hands me is a service manual. I say, what do we do with this? He says, we turn to page one. Big Daddy was the first man who ever talked to me about the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never heard it the 3 years I've been sober. Never heard it. He says, Johnny, you're sick physically, you're sick mentally, and you're sick spiritually. I said, yes, sir, I understand that. He said, you see that triangle on the wall? I said, yes, sir, I see it. He says, which side is longer? I said, they're all three equal. He said, you dadgum right, don't you forget that. He said, let me tell you about that physical illness you have. We treat that with the unity part of that triangle, the group. He says, now I ain't talking about going to meetings. He says, you can be anonymous going to meetings. But when you go to a group regularly, and you're attending that group regularly, and you're a member of that group, running with those same group of guys all the time, that's how we treat the physical part of this illness. He said, when two alcoholics are together, it does something for us. He said, now there is a difference between going to the meetings and going to a group. Said, you get your butt in one group at a time. That's your home group. And we'd already started our own meeting in Lawdy, the little town I was living in, when they threw me out of start. So I had a group. I said, I understand that part. You treat the physical part of illness with the group. Not going to meetings, with the group. He said, you're right. He said, but it doesn't do anything for your screwed up mind. He said, you see that recovery part of the triangle? I said, yes, sir. He said, that's the steps. So that's where we take that sick mind of yours. He said, now there's a difference between working those steps and applying those principles to your life. He said, anybody can work the steps. He said, but to apply those principles to your life is a whole different daggum deal. I said, yes, sir, I understand that. He said, and it produces that spiritual awakening that you need so bad. He said, and we take that awakened spirit into service work. He said, now let me tell you something, son. There's a difference between doing service work and being of service to your fellow man. He said, anybody can do service work. He said, but to be of actual service to your fellow man is a whole different deal. He says, you apply equal tension to all three sides of that. Don't you just get hung up on the meetings. Don't you just get hung up on the group. Don't you just get hung up on the steps. Don't you just get hung up on the service work. You pay equal attention to all three sides. And you will find that fulfilled sobriety you've always craved. And he was right. He was the only man that ever talked to me about that. He told me about that. That little group that we started is still going. We celebrated 10 or 11 years the other day. We got about 20 guys in it, and it's going good. It's going good. It's a good little group. Big Daddy's still my sponsor. And I called him before I came up here. I said, what's the story? I call him before I speak every time. He tells me the same thing. Keep it honest or keep it short. Every time. Now, look, y'all. Any story that doesn't include the family is a short story. That little girl who suffered so much because of me. Well, she went on, she got her master's degree. She's got her master's degree. She's a speech pathologist right now. When she was in high school, she ran for homecoming queen. I was probably 4 years sober then. And she was one of five girls who got to be on the homecoming court. And they brought her out there that night. And I'm sitting in the stadium with my wife and my mother, my grandmother, my family. Look, I'm applying these principles to my life. I'm not apart from anymore. I'm part of this. And I get to sit there with her. And they announce the winner, and she wins. And I get to see her little eyes, her little expression on her face. And she's looking for a mom, and she's looking for her friends. And baby, but you can't suck that out of a whiskey bottle. You can't get that out of a whiskey bottle. She got married last year, and she wanted me and her brother to walk her down the aisle, and her mother waited on her as maid of honor. Where else can you get that? The 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the 12 concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have 36 principles in here, not 12. Don't you forget that. 36 principles, and you get that. That boy, that little boy that was just so disturbed by my drinking, when he was a senior in high school, he decided he wanted to start drag racing. And I live about an hour from the drag strip, and I had this old Impala SS, and I put a little nitrous kit on it. I've always been a little horsepower junkie, okay? And so we go drag racing, okay? We're drag racing. And it's hobby class racing. And on the way home that night, he looked at me and says, "Daddy, this is the best day of my life. I'm with my boy on the best day of his life. You don't understand. I'm a destroyer of lives, but I'm with him on his best." He got married 3 years ago, married a little school teacher. I gave him a little piece of land to put a trailer on, and he was naming off who was going to be in his wedding. And I said, "Who's going to be your best man?" He looked at me and said, "You are. You're my best friend." Where else can you get this? The 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the 12 concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's doing good. He works for me about 4 days a week, and him and his partners got him about 300 mama cows. He runs on the side. I called him today. He'd been hauling hay all day. And he gave me and my wife the greatest gift, they've ever could have given us. He gave us our granddaughter on July 29th. Yeah. It's so funny about that. See, my father was so affected by the pains of my drinking. When I was about a little over a year sober, there was a trailer down at the sawmill, and I said, "Daddy, I want that trailer." He said, "What do you want that trailer for, boy?" I said, "I'm going to put drunks in it." In Bradford County, we don't have any facilities. Nothing. There's nothing. No detoxes, nothing. So I learned how to do it myself. I started detoxing drunks in that trailer. I put a couple in there at a time. My sister named it the screw-up trailer. Because you've really screwed up your life to land in that trailer. And he became interested. He wanted to know where I was going. Who's in that trailer? Where are you speaking at? It was just a change of life, and he enjoyed it. He got sick, and on June 9th this year, I lost my father. And I'm sitting there with my father in his last hours with my sister and my brother and our children and the family, and I'm holding him. And all of that nastiness that I'd caused all those years was gone, y'all. It was gone. And I'm sitting there, and I'm just so grateful that I found y'all. Because he went to the next world knowing I'm all right in this one. And a month later, when that little granddaughter was born, she had his eyes and his lips. And I think of, "Oh, thank you, Jesus. Where else can I even see something like this but in here?" Let me tell you something. My grandmother used to tell me the story. There's this little boy named David. He was a shepherd. David's daddy looked at him and said, "Look, David, I ain't heard from your brothers in a little while. Here's some bread. Here's some cheese. Run down there to the battle." David's in the army. "Find out what's going on. Come back. Tell me what's going on." David gets down there, and his brothers are hiding in a hole. And there's a big guy on the hill talking bad about them, talking bad about God. David sold out on God. You understand? Sold out. David looked at his brothers. I know I'm paraphrasing this. David looked at his brothers and said, "Get out of that hole and fight him." They said, "Shut up, David. Get down here." David said, "I'll fight him." David sold out on God. Old King said, "Who said that?" David said, "I said it." King said, "Here's my shield, here's my sword, here's my helmet." You know what David said? "I'll go with what I got." Y'all know how this ended? Bad for the big guy, okay? You're sitting here and you say, "Man, I want to start sponsoring these people, but what if I don't say the right thing?" God said, "No, babe, I got your back. Bring what you got." You're saying, "I want to get involved at the district level, and I'm afraid I won't fit in." God said, "No, baby, I got your back. Bring what you got." You're saying, "I want to get involved down there at the treatment center, but what if I'm not?" Bring what you got. God's got your back. Are you bringing what you got? God's either everything or he's nothing. There's this little boy, and he grew up in the turn of the century, and he went to this old store, old country store, and there's a big old barrel of candy there, boys. It's a big old barrel of candy, all right? And he's looking at that barrel of candy, and the man behind the counter said, "Boy, get you some of that candy." Little boy said, "Uh-uh." His mama said, "Son, get you some of that candy." Little boy said, "Uh-uh." He looked at the man behind the counter and said, I want you to do it. The big man smiled, reached down there, got some candy, put it in the sack, and gave it to the little boy. They were walking down the sidewalk, and the little boy's mama said, son, why wouldn't you get none of that candy? The little boy looked at his mama and said, Mama, do you see the size of that man's hands? That's the way it is with us. Let go of that little bit of stuff in yours and grab the hold of the hand of God. Let me tell you something. There's some people who know me as Mr. Tatum. They know me on a business level, very, very small. There's some people who know me as Johnny T, Alcoholics Anonymous. They know me a little bit better. There's two out there that know me as Dad. Oh, yeah. Our relationship's a lot closer. There's one girl out there that calls me John. She is the only person in this world that calls me John. I've been with her 35 years. She knows everything about me, and I know everything about her. Shouldn't our relationship with God be that way? Shouldn't our relationship with God be on that level? See, I tried that Mr. God level. It didn't work. It drove me insane. There's so much for you out there. There's so much. Baby, we can only scratch the surface. Will you bring what you got? Will you bring to this what you got? And great things will come to pass for you and us. This is the great fact for us. Thank y'all so much for letting me be here.